Hi, everybody. This is Mark Ciaffardini. Thanks so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Oh, man, we want to welcome you. We want to take you to a world of pure imagination. We are thrilled and delighted to be speaking to our next guest, composer extraordinaire Joby Talbot. They say candy is dandy, but music is just a little bit sweeter. So this sounds a little corny, but Neil Hannon's songs are the chocolate core to the story, but the candy coating is obviously, without a doubt, Joby Talbot's music. Thank you so much for being on the show. How's things in your world?
Hi, Mark. They're good, thank you very much. A bit freezing cold here in London, but yeah, life is good. Crazy busy as usual. Yeah, I had an insanely intense 2023, and I'm hoping that 2024 will be just as much fun, maybe just a little less fraught. Yeah, all good. How's things with you?
I have to admit that we share some commonalities in both our professional worlds. Actually, I do this as a hobby. My real profession is architecture for hotels. Right. And so between that, having a newborn last year and
trying
to manage, thank you so much, and manage this hobby, it is a lot. It's like juggling chainsaws on fire is a good way to put it.
Yes. Well, I've got a 2-year-old, so he's not a newborn anymore, but still, you know, like, they like to play with your mind and physicality. Like, things like, they get a cold, so you get a cold, but then they don't let you recover from the cold. No, they're going to keep you up every night until you die. I don't know why. There's a design flaw. Yeah. Somebody needs to have a look. Some architect needs to take a look at mankind and fix it.
Maybe, you know, through the period of evolution, 7.5 million years, maybe we'll get to the perfect society. But
it's all looking good so far. I think I'm heading massively in the right direction at the moment.
I can relate. My daughter has had an ear infection, and so the last two nights she was almost acting as if a newborn. Every 2-3 hours she was up, uncomfortable. But while we love our kids, we love their screams, we love their sounds, I love your sound. Joby, please tell us, in the world of musicality, what got you into this business? What did you fall in love with? What were the first few strings, first few instruments you felt like you needed to grab hold of?
Well, yeah, I started playing the piano when I was a kid. I think I was sort of living some various dreams of being a musician. And she never really had the opportunity. So as soon as I was old enough, she sat me down at the piano and didn't let me get up again until I'd done my practice. And I found that making up music was an awful lot more fun than doing scales and arpeggios and studies. So I started writing my own music and played my first piece in public when I was 9. Wasn't very good at all, but still. I fell deeply in love with music from there, really. And really, it really kind of all kicked off when I used to play the oboe, and I started playing oboes in actually quite good orchestras when I was a teenager. And, you know, I'll never forget, like, the moment when I sat in the orchestra and heard, like, an actually quite good string section, like, come to life around me. And, yeah, I think it was like a Damascene kind of light bulb moment. I knew what I wanted to do with my life, and here I am now.
Well, you know, I had a talk with Randy Edelman last year, and he had a complete musical career before he even got into film scoring. And he said one of the most interesting things about growing up at his point in life is, if you kind of like draw a line in the human existence, the Beatles, everything before the Beatles, music was not cool. And then after they came out, they were cool. So it sounds like, you know, you're born in 71, so you're kind of after the Beatles. Playing piano, playing oboe, was it cool? Did you feel like, yeah, this is, you know, I don't need to hide this. I'm going to be Joby the musician.
I don't think anybody at my school, my peers, thought it was very cool. I mean, I was only into classical music. I was born in 71, which I think is like the greatest year for pop music that ever was. If you think of the music that came out in 1971, but of course I was only a you know, blissfully unaware of it. I was busy having ear infections and keeping my parents up all night. So when I first, yeah, I came to music through classical music. And I am a classical, I am basically a classical composer. I'm classically trained. I went to music college and studied composition. I learned Bach four-part harmony, and, you know, I learned to play in classical orchestras. But I never understood why you were supposed to like one or the other thing. I think it's different now, but when I was, so this is back in the 80s, it seemed that, you know, the people I knew in orchestras and stuff, you know, they listened to Beethoven and Brahms and Shostakovich. And then the people I knew at school listened to, you know, the Smiths and, you know, Duran Duran. And I didn't know anybody apart from me who listened to all of those things and kind of liked it. So I really sort of felt from a very early stage that you know, there was stuff to love and stuff to learn from in all kinds of music. And I was, you know, as I say, while I was playing in orchestras and singing in choirs, and I was also, you know, I also had a really, really, really terrible rock band at school that I played bass really badly for. And my life was sort of, it's interesting how those kind of seeds that you sow when you're little kind of often lead you on a path. And you know, my life since then in music has been about collaborating with all kinds of different people in all kinds of different musical and artistic ways.
Well, it's funny you say that. I'm thinking immediately of a parallel. You know, my older daughter is big into streaming. So it's, you can start something. If you're not into it, you flip on to the next thing. And I remember when I was a kid, you know, we had a very limited selection of VHSs. Hmm. So, you know, good, bad, or in between, that's what you had. And you kind of formed your taste.
You found stuff to love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, is there, maybe is the modern musical world really about meshing things together, finding the most ingredients to put in the pot, or is it trying to fine tune? Because what you said, you don't need to, you know, go lean one way or the other. You can, you know, combine things and have different interests. I was just thinking that might be an interesting musical mindset.
Absolutely.
For composers.
Well, I think it's very interesting. Yeah. So when I was a kid, I had a record player, and I had, you know, to start with, just access to the records that, you know, that my mom had bought. And then, you know, when I started to put, you know, get some pocket money together, I went out and I bought the first records of my choosing. But, you know, like a few a year. I mean, by the time I was at college, maybe I had a record collection of maybe, I don't know, 30, 40 LPs. And that's, you can listen to the radio, but if you actually want to, like, sit down and listen to something repeatedly, you only have what you own. And the idea that you could just, at the click of a mouse, just access any music that's been made in any country by anyone ever is not something that was so you found stuff to like about stuff, even stuff that, I mean, I had records that, you know, like Toko, embarrassing to admit to, but, you know, like, you bought them now, so you better find something to like. And I think that's kind of, you know, that's, I'm grateful for that as a starting point, to be honest. The first records my mum had Bridge Over Troubled Water. She had Switched on Bach, Wendy Carlos. She had Jesus Christ Superstar. She had the complete Mahler symphonies. And, you know, just random stuff. And I'd listen to it all because, you know, that was all I had. And it's funny now, like, I'm, you know, just in my 50s and coming back to some of that music that I listened to so intently when I was... And that's the other thing, like serial listening. When you're a kid, just like really deep diving into this stuff, listening to it again and again and again, just like, you know, I'll hear things in that music now if I come back to it, think, oh yeah, that's something I do in my own music, that's where it came from, you know. but I think you know, I have a theory that, you know, that working in music is a bit like working in horticulture. That, you know, like hybridization is the thing, you know. If you take like something from, you know, like a meters rhythm section, you know, and you ally it to a kind of, you know, kind of a minimalist mechanical string section from John Adams, and, you know, and then put it through a sort of Tchaikovsky filter. And, you know, you end up with kind of different and new and kind of robust musical stock.
I Can't disagree with that. Can you go back to your 9-year-old self? Was there any genius in that first piano composition? Was there any genius bits in your rock band? Because I think I'm thinking specifically about my English teacher had us write the classic novel of Mice and Men. Our teacher said, expand your mind, write the next chapter. It's like, wait. The book is over. She's like, no. What would happen? So I wrote it. And I thought to myself, like, how could I see this playing out in the style, giving my own freedoms? But to that respect, is there things that in your youth you might have thought were garbage and you get a little older, like, yeah, it probably is garbage. But no, there might be like one gem, one idea, anything.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I just yesterday had a call from my old head of music from school, who I haven't spoken to in decades. I think I spoke to him once after I left school in 1989. That would have been about 20 years ago. And then yesterday he called me again. Strange. And I remember that there was, this would have been later, this was probably when I was about 14 or 15. The similar thing. He gave me a piece of paper with one bar of music and three parts written in one measure. And then I just had to basically fill out the rest of the page. It was just an exercise. It wasn't meant to be a creative, particularly, you know, like artistic thing. It was meant to be just, you know, show how you can write in three parts for the duration of this, you know, this page of, of manuscript paper. And so I went away and did it. And I came back and I showed it to him. And his, like, jaw fell on the floor. He was like, well, this is amazing. I was like, is it? I mean, I've been playing music and, you know, writing my own stuff and noodling away, but I never really thought that anybody would kind of think it might be kind of good, like, you know, kind of thing you could do for a living. And he was like, yeah, he was so enthusiastic. And this was not a guy who'd ever really been very enthusiastic about anything I'd done up to that point. And anyway, I was just telling him about it yesterday. I said, you know, that day when I came and said, you know, that kind of started everything for me, you know, so thank you. And yeah, he was like, you didn't seem to realize what you had there. I was like, no, too right, I didn't. So yeah, and then I just started writing down the stuff I've been kind of playing, and then I just, you know, it was like I just found my thing. You know, I think if you have kids, then you know the best thing you can hope for them is that they find their thing, because you know once you found it, even if you don't end up making a living from it, even if you just do it as a hobby, something you enjoy, it's something that makes your life meaningful. It could be the kind of center point of your kind of emotional existence and the way everything else just revolves around that. I mean, for me, the thing I discovered was that I had a lot I wanted to say emotionally, a lot of I needed to get out. And this was the way I felt able to do it. I couldn't write it. I couldn't put it into words. I couldn't really say it out loud. Suddenly I found that through music, I was able to kind of express it. And when I listened to other people's music, the sort of deep, you know, really kind of profound emotional effect that it had on me and how I related to the music I was hearing at the time, I found that I was able to take that on board and then filter it through my own subconscious and then, you know, put it out the other end as something that kind of meant something to me and really was expressing something that I needed to say at that point.
Well, what was the first piece that you were super proud of, like gave you the same feeling that listening to other people's music gave you when it was in the world? Going back to that, maybe that test, like, I did that? How, you know, okay. Well, this guy's good.
I wrote a little piano piece when I was about 15, and it was the one and only piece I ever wrote, like, without sitting at a piano, actually. And I don't know, I just sort of, I just had a study period, like, empty, and I got out this piece of paper, and I just wrote the thing, and then when I got home that evening, I played it on the piano, and with a couple of minor changes, it kind of just worked. It was only a little piano piece, but I was kind of amazed. I kind of figured that it was like a sort of gift from the cosmos, that piece. I don't know. And that, yeah, then from there, then I started writing. And, you know, and then, you know, fast forward maybe 15 years or something, I finally did write something that really was good. I mean, this piece I'm talking about means a lot to me, but I'm not like play it in public, that's for sure, or publish it. But I wrote a string quartet when I was about 28 that I thought, actually, you know what, this is pretty good. But by that time, I already had like a career, and I was already, only a couple of years away from being published by my publisher. So, I was quite a long way into it before I actually did something that was actually good. I mean, you got to, for me anyway, I had to write an awful lot of not very good stuff that some people were very kind about, which, you file that under juvenilia and move on. But yeah, I wasn't a particularly cool, I was writing all that time, but I was still learning, and I'm still learning now. I think it's, ideally you just get better and better and better. For an artist like me anyway, that's how it works for me. I'm just trying and trying. I never find it easy. I hope that the next thing will be better than the one before. Try, fail, fail again, all that stuff. I know other people are sort of gifted with the kind of, the ability to just come fully formed into this world, but certainly that's not the way it was for me.
Well, actually, you're in more common company that you think about. You think of like other contemporaries, artists who are in the film community. Danny Elfman talks about, he considers going working or on a presentation or composing music more like a well. You're going to the well and you try to put your bucket in. He's like, there's got to be water down there. Just keeps putting the rope in. It's like, I don't hear water, but it's got to be down there. And John Powell says that he's, written, some of the best things 20 minutes before the presentation. Ilan Ishkari, kind of similar thing. So I think there's, it doesn't really come, or even maybe John Williams says famously, this is paraphrased, but something like, inspiration doesn't come out of, like a bolt of the blue. It's like the 11th hour before something's due. And it's like, what do you think? It's like, we love it. Okay, great. Ooh,
I know. It is a bit scary. In that regard, it's not a very relaxing line of work because, you just don't know. You don't know when it's going to arrive and or what it's going to be when it does arrive, which is all well and good if you're just sitting there, musing away, thinking, I might write another piece one day. But when you've got like the executives, like phones ringing off the hook, the muse hasn't descended yet. Sorry, that doesn't really fly. I mean, I have. For me, I try to kind of lose myself to get into a zone where I can come up with stuff, and that's only like a. It's the most important bit, but it's a tiny bit. Like that, the whole, 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration thing, I think is true that once you have something, a germ of something that could actually be good, you then got to set to work on it. You got to, grow it and, pin it down and all this stuff. But I try to kind of go into a place where it's a sort of meditative state and I'm just kind of coming up with stuff. And, sometimes you find that place quite easily. Sometimes you just don't find that place at all. But it does have a sort of strange thing, which I can remember having written very little of, those creative. I can't remember those moments very much. And my theory here is that that writing music is all about moving forward in time, trying to capture the next thing, and it's all about sort of the kinetic forward flow of sound. And while you're working, when you're in that zone of actually creating, you're not really engaging any part of your brain that has to do with the past. So you're not thinking, the memory section of your brain is just off and you're just moving forward. When things are going really, really well, and then you come back the next morning, you found you wrote a load of stuff. You have no memory of doing it, but it appears to be in your handwriting or on your hard drive. So you must have done it. And in that stuff, there could be good things that you can then turn into.
Oh, that's great. It sounds like you're speaking about my, when I was in college, I was on the judo team. And I always remember, and I tell people this, that like when you're grappling with somebody, I don't know if I'm just doing it wrong, but I have this tunnel vision where all I see is this. I see my hands and the other person, and maybe there's a parallel there.
Yeah, I'm trying to kind of, especially when you're trying to do something creative and artistic, it's a bit scary because, as I say, you never know when it's going to arrive. And then if you find that if you are on a really hard deadline, like I am currently, you sort of, when you do have a good idea, you kind of don't trust it because you think to yourself, am I only like pretending to myself that this is a good idea because I know I have to deliver it tomorrow? or is it actually a good idea? And then you find you can't judge. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think there's so many things involved in writing music. There's good taste, or otherwise, there's just sort of your imagination, your kind of creative, dreamy kind of self. There's the ability to grab a good idea, pin it down, and actually capture it. That's another skill. Then there's all the sort of technical stuff, whether it's to do with computers or audio or writing music or playing musical instruments, I mean, all the elements of that. And then there's, just your kind of work ethic and, how you're going to, how good at you are actually at, focusing on stuff. And, all these things combine to, to work well when they work well. But it's so many different things that you're trying to get in a given moment. And when the clock's ticking down, it's quite alarming to think you've got to try and pull all this together. And I don't know. At the moment, I'm having a weird one, which is that having worked on Wonka all of last year and half of the year before, that now I'm coming back to kind of one of my own non-movie. It's a ballet, a new ballet, which I'm running for the choreo for Christopher Wheeldon for Australian Ballet. And suddenly there's no director, no Paul King saying, yeah, that's fine, because you change this, and also give me three different options, and let's change it. And anyway, oh, by the way, the picture's completely changed since you wrote that and all that stuff. Now suddenly I'm waiting for that other person to kind of come and tell me what to do, and then remembering that on this project there isn't one. It's just me. I got to write the music and I've got to deliver it to the choreographer, and he might have some changes, but it's not like scoring a movie where the movie exists. You're putting music to it, and if it's not functioning in the way the director imagined it, then you have to change it so that it is. They're going to make the choreography on the music that I write. So it's a whole shift. It's like suddenly I've got to be the kind of, buck stops with me kind of person in this. And it's weird, to try and force your brain into that different way of thinking about it.
So you are literally setting the stage acoustically. So you're the writer of this. If they're doing their choreography to what you've written, okay. Yeah. Well, I understand the bullets that are perspiring as to why you're in the world. But yeah. I think that's got to be freeing too. You are, if there is nobody. I mean, a lot of times they say composers write in a vacuum or in a silo. But I think at this point, that's got to be a vote of confidence, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, I really am happy that film music is not all that I do, or TV music, because it means that when I'm collaborating with the director, if they don't like the kind of wonderful thing that I've had in mind, that's okay, because, in a couple of weeks' time, I'm just going to be doing my own thing, and so I'm not going to it's never like, oh, this is my moment. This is my opportunity to kind of, write my kind of, the BMX flying off an ETQ. I can be like, kind of, okay, well, whatever you want, because I know I can write that cue for myself in a couple of weeks' time and one of my ballets or operas or concert pieces.
Well, let's jump into the meat and the potatoes of this interview. Wonka, did I hear you right? You worked in 18 months on that? How is
something
that?
Like that?
That's
yeah.
Like a rarity in film circles, huh?
Yes, but it's I knew it was going to be a protracted and really demanding experience, because I think Paul King is a very sort of organic kind of director. The picture kind of develops and responds to the music. Firstly, music is hugely important in his directorial world. I'm lucky in that the two directors I kind of work with these days, Garth Jennings and Paul King, are both directors who value music so highly. And they both appreciate what music can actually bring to the table, how you can leave so much of storytelling and kind of shift the focus and stuff to the music. And you don't have to do it all with dialogue and sound effects and picture. But yeah, I knew that it was going to be a demanding thing. It went on rather longer than I thought, but I wasn't surprised, because what we were trying to do was really, really ambitious, and where we were starting from was kind of complicated. I came aboard the picture you know, they'd been working on it for years before I came on board. They were quite a long way into post-production before I went in and watched it and met Paul King. And it was in a place that that wasn't quite working musically, or you know, and we needed to get it from that place to the place it ended up. But with all the other elements of the film were also similarly radically changing. So you're kind of working on this thing, a moving target. You know, you pretty much guarantee that as soon as you had something ready to present, it was going to be completely out of date because everything would change. And it was pretty pretty tense at times. Of course, now looking back, you know, through rose-tinted spectacles of the success of the film and how much, you know, I love it and people seem to love it. You know, my daughter and all her friends are mad for it. And, you know, it's so lovely and you forget about all the hard times. But it was the most hard work, the most difficult and challenging movie project I've worked on for sure.
Kind of boggling that you came in late, so to speak, because, you know, it seems like if they had so much of the movie already set without a whole lot of reshoots, I guess that you were composing on top of Neil's songs. How was that dynamic?
Well, so you know that I have a long history with Neil going back to the 90s. Like I played in his band between 93 and 2000, or 2001 when I left. And like for a lot of that time, we were like on the road the whole time. I didn't have an apartment. You know, there's no point. We were just living in the tour bus, you know, touring around. So for a very, you know, like, exciting period in my 20s, you know, being on the road with a successful outfit, having just a whale of a time and learning so much, you know, it was all, you know, and I was sort of the MD playing keyboards, but also doing all the orchestral arrangements for these big kind of, you know, it was a sort of height of Britpop and Neil's Band of Divine Comedy. There was a sort of like, there was a kind of a rediscovery of John Barry and Burt Bacharach and people in the sort of late 90s in this country, and the sort of easy listening, the kind of cool, it was part of this sort of, you know, cool Britannia, harking back to the 60s kind of thing. And we just been like kind of merrily doing stuff that evidently kind of chimed with that. We, you know, it wasn't planned. We happened to have this song that, One DJ in England like picked up on, and the next thing you know, we went from playing in front of, you know, a couple of hundred people every night and selling them, you know, a handful of records when we put one out, to suddenly being on the TV and like, you know, in the top 10 and having errors. It was great. But then, you know, I finally left, like, you know, I was getting more and more of my own stuff. I realized I was having to turn cool stuff that I was being asked to do down because I was going on the road. The Divine Comedy, which is basically Neil's thing. So I left. And we worked a couple of times after that. I did the strings on the album after I left. And then I got him in to sing the closing credit version of So Long, Thanks for All the Fish on St. Joe's Guide to Galaxy. And that was in 2005. But we haven't worked together since. And we'll see him from time to time. We're kind of in touch. He moved to Ireland, so he's in a different country. And then I heard that he was writing the songs for Wonka, and I was like, good for you. And I wondered whether I might get a call, but then I had dinner with him during that period, and I said, oh, who's writing the score? And they were like, oh, we don't know yet. I was like, okay, I wonder if anyone's ever going to ask me. I didn't say it. And then I got a call from Paul King's people saying, could you come in and watch the movie and chat with Paul? You know, I did kind of think, well, look, you know, the last movie I did was, you know, Sing and Sing 2, you know, two massively successful movies with songs. And I was in the band with the songwriter you've hired for 8 years. It seems like a bit of a no-brainer to me. You know, you're casting it out far and wide about who you're going to hire, but like, hi. So I went in and I said, look, you know, I know Neil's musical language probably better than anyone apart from him. And I understand these songs. And give me the songs to do my arrangements, my takes on them, and then, you know, let me set use the score to set the songs up. And Paul King, who I think originally was thinking that maybe they didn't even need a composer, maybe they could, you could just work with the songs and repurposing. So, like say, for example, The Graduate. I was watching it the other day, and then, you know, Mike Nichols is just, the way he's just using Simon Garfunkel's music, and sometimes it sort of becomes quite scorey, but it's all just based on the pop music of, you know, those great songs. And I think he wanted to keep it as close to the song world as possible. And I was like, well, yeah, that's exactly what you should do, because we don't want to feel when we get to a song that we've left one movie and we're going to another movie. I mean, the trickiest thing with movies with songs in is to not let the songs park themselves in the middle of the film like a great big, you know, alien malevolent being, and just derail the storytelling, derail the pacing, take you emotionally away from, you know, the thing you're watching, and then, you know, just keep breaking the spell. It's so hard for suddenly people who've been talking for 20 minutes to start singing and you not to think, hang on a minute, and just come out of it just briefly. And once you let the audience go, well, it's getting them back in. It's not really fulfilling. So, you know, Paul and I were really much of the same mind in this. And, you know, he came around to my studio and we just like playing the song melodies in against different parts of the picture and seeing what worked. And then it's my job to try and, you know, make a really good score out of those elements that were, you know, taken from the songs and yet make it function.
Well, you know, I understand exactly what you're saying. And one of my favorite track on the entire album is Wonka's Case. And then you have like a little bit of, not Jewelry Box, but like,
Music Box. Yeah.
Music Box. Yeah. So you definitely were able to imbue what we had just heard with a song and sort of extrapolate the cues under it and give it your own little spin. And so I think that's fascinating. Yeah. So it felt in the same world.
No. And then it's, I mean, doing things like, you know, like if you can make the dynamic shape of the song last longer than the song. This is just an overly simplified example, but say you have a song that starts quiet and it gets more intense and more loud and then subsides again. Well, if you can write score that, like, several minutes before the song has even started, it's already started that journey of building an intensity, so then we get to the song and then we continue building an intensity, and then, and, you know, conversely at the other end, you might want to pick up where the momentum of the song left and then die away. And that way you're making kind of bigger kind of architectural chapters within the movie that you're including the songs in. And then you start to get this kind of organic kind of ebb and flow complementing the narrative of the film and, you know, and helping integrate the songs into the whole of the movie. And that's, I mean, with Sing, obviously it was like songs taken from, and I had nothing to do with the arrangements of those songs mostly. So I'm just getting the finished article, and it could be going out of a, you know, a Beatles song into a Ariana Grande song and telling some narrative in the meantime. And, you know, it's that was, you know, that's one set of challenges. And then with Wonka, where I'm taking stuff, I'm unpacking the songs and loading them into the score and rebuilding it all up. And then there's another set of challenges. But I do, I mean, I enjoy doing it. Yeah, Wonka's Case is, there's the music box when he opens his kind of traveling chocolate factory thing and tells the backstory of his mother. Yeah, he had this kind of, yes, you say like the jewelry box, and music box thing, you know, bell-like thing. And it plays an arrangement of a song that we're actually not going to hear until quite a long time later in the film, which is World of Your Own. But of course, when Willie opens his shop and sings World of Your Own, so, you know, that's his dream come to fruition. And when he's telling us about his childhood, it makes sense that we should be hearing the music of his dream, but in this tiny childlike way. And we soon found, I mean, you wouldn't expect people to notice this, but hopefully it works on a subliminal level. We found different storylines within the film that we could apply different songs to. So World of Your Own becomes about Willie's dream to bring chocolate to the world. For a Moment is all about Willie and Noodles' burgeoning relationship, and they're learning to trust one another. Pure Imagination becomes about Noodles' search for her family. And yeah, it was sort of trial and error, just putting the different things against different parts of the film and seeing how they worked. I mean, we had a version of that Wonka's Case cue where I did a music box arrangement of Pure Imagination, which was such a lovely thing. But when they decided that no, that's going to be for a different storyline, I had to replace it. But you know, like in there, yeah. So that sort of gives you a sense of how we were just trying stuff out, going quite a long way in a direction, really make something really, really good, and then change our minds and do it all over again.
Well, I think ultimately you made the right decision, because what you're doing is you're giving like an appetizer. You're laying the groundwork subliminally on a low. And sometimes, you know, I always go back to this, the discussion I had with Michael Giacchino when he scored Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And the reason he was very
good. I love that score.
If you see him again,
tell him what a fan I'm of that. I thought what he did with the Star Trek, the Jerry Goldsmith material, that was just genius. He knows what he's doing, that Michael.
I agree too. And I think the ultimate point he was making is, he said the reason he was very hesitant to use, whether it was the Sandy Courage or the Goldsmith, it was just, it didn't feel earned. If you tried to use it on these characters before they had their arrival, mm-hmm. their moment, it just felt a little cheated. And I love listening to both the score and the songs in this, because very little was used from the Gene Wilder one. You know, actually it's another period of his life. I think the only thing that was referenced was Candy is Dandy. And that wasn't even a song, you know, it's like, you're a different person 20, 30 years later. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And our version of Pure Imagination, we have, you know, I did an instrumental version of it for the opening titles. With all sort of bells and bowed crotals and, you know, just lovely and silvery and beautiful and dreamlike, if I could imagine it. And at the end, we have Neil's cool new arrangement of it, sort of Talking Heads, kind of ELO, Divine Comedy, I guess, version of it. And then in between, just the tiniest little bits, just the opening three-note chime thing from the original song, just the opening couple of measures, you know, just enough to kind of keep reminding you that, you know, there's the potential for this song to finally be heard, until we get to right at the end of the movie and Willie says to Noodle and says, "Come with," and then you're like, here we go, finally.
One question I have to ask is, again, I'm going to go back to you wearing the scarf, looking like a very dapper Sam Mendes. The idea of maybe like a Bond movie or other, what you call musicals, where you have to bifurcate or sometimes combine and elaborate score cue versus source material, put them together. In do you know the story of any of the Bond movies? You know, you got Goldfinger, you got You Only Live Twice. Does the song start first and then the John Barry or...
I don't know how he did it. He didn't write all the songs either, did he? And of course he didn't write the original...
No.
One of the great chords, isn't it? Bang! That chord, whatever it is.
Is that the test to be a Brit, is that you have to hum the bars coming into the world? You need to know that when you grow.
Yeah, that is one of the, that's in the citizenship test. I don't know how John Barry went about doing that, but God, it's good. It's the other composer of that ilk that I just was like mad for when I was starting out was Lalo Schifrin. The way that he can use all the kind of pop jazz elements, but make them function in the way that a straight orchestral score would, you know, the way that he uses it to kind of, you know, enhance the tension and really kind of build things. Love all that. But you know, it's quite, I mean, it's, you know, when you have other people's material to build stuff with, it's a different challenge. In one way, you're not starting with a completely blank sheet of paper. You know, you've got something. But on the other hand, it's somebody else's thing, and you know, your own material you make up from scratch is sort of, by definition, has the sort of DNA of your whole kind of working practice within it, and it's going to be easier to build your, you know, your building, your musical building from the bricks that you also you know, invented, sure. Rather than trying to do it with somebody else's bricks. But yeah, I mean, I enjoy both challenges, I must say.
Well, I'd like to throw a little praise your way. In an interview, you had said that you are in love and constantly impressed by the intensity of the emotional journey of the great pieces of classical music. I have been in love with the journey you took me on for the intergalactic extraordinary adventure story, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Holy, holy crap. You think about cues like the Planet Factory floor, Earth Mark II. Just, I mean, I don't even know how a human being can put that together. The drums, the horns. Can we go back to 2005 or prior to preparing that score? Some of those cues and what Mad Alchemy produced what I'm hearing and in love with.
Well, you know, that was a weird one because so it was the first movie I ever did. I'd worked with Garth Jennings on a couple of things, like commercial we did, and I was just, I think I was just really lucky in that he was a guy who absolutely loves music, and he made his name doing you know, pop videos, really kind of famous and great pop videos. But he was always making films to music, but he'd never had somebody score of this picture. And I did this commercial that's supposed to be like a kind of 90-second disaster movie, and we did it with full orchestra and everything, and yeah, it was great. So when they got asked to do Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, he wanted me to write the music, and you know, this was a big humongous step up from anything I'd done before with picture. I'd done some successful TV stuff in England, and my manager at the time had worked a lot with Craig Armstrong, and she said, well, often Craig will write some music in advance and go and record it as like a sort of musical mood board they can, you know, they can have while they're cutting away, and you know, and I thought, well, this would be really kind of useful. I'd like to go out there if I can, you know, give me the budget, record some music and have that kind of sitting around kind of informing the director, but also just to make me think, okay, I'm on the right track here, because you know, not to just wait until, you know, get it all wrong at the very end and they get fired. Garth gave me a version of the picture. A lot of it was just storyboard before they went off to shoot. So I had a version of the, so I had a rough idea of how long certain scenes were. So I just cherry picked the most important scenes, like Planet Factory 4 and Earth Mark 2, and just wrote pieces of music. And then we went to Prague and recorded them. And then when Garth finished shooting, they went into the editing suite. We gave him this sort of album of music. And amazingly enough, like a ton of it, especially towards the end of the film, you know, survived. I mean, obviously we had to, like, you know, change it. But yeah, so Planet Factory 4, I wrote before they'd even filmed anything. And, but I was insane for that book growing up. So I became like the expert, the hitchhiker's. If they need to ask somebody how to pronounce a certain alien's name, I get a phone call. how do you say Hamakabula? That was an amazing experience. They Garth wanted, once they go out into space, we didn't want to hear any pre-existing music. So if they turned the radio on in the Heart of Gold, we needed to hear what was in the radio in space. You know, if they went to a church and they sang a hymn, we need to, you know, what does the congregation of aliens sing when they're in the temple? You know, everything. What, you know, the music that the guide made. And coming back to what I was saying about songs earlier on, the first thing he said to me about it after asking me to do it was like, the big problem with this is the guide entries. How do you stay faithful to the you know, the original version, the radio play, and then the TV series. Keep those Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy entries without it derailing the narrative, because fundamentally, if you're on the radio and the door bashes open, you hear a big roar, and then the calm voice of the Hitchhiker's Guide tells you what a Vogon is, then it's all very funny and also very informative, because you can't see anything. Whereas, this is a big kind of multi-million-dollar Hollywood movie, they're going to have a very convincing looking large green alien. We don't need a voice to tell us what it is. We can see what it is. But obviously, you can only lose what's great about those guide entries. So he was like, what can we do to make sure they don't kind of just keep stopping everything in its tracks? And I had this idea, which was that the queue should be composed so that they run from the live action stuff on either side of those animated entries and run right through it and out the other side. But that for the duration of when we're in the Hitchhiker's Guidebook itself, it's the same piece of music, but it's not orchestra now, it's bleeps. It's all electronic bleeps. But the piece is continuing, like it hasn't noticed that now it's no longer in the live action part of the film. And it comes out the other side, and the orchestra comes crashing back in, and the queue will be finished. And that was my kind of. So that was like, I was given such license to do. I had no idea what I was doing. It was the first time ever out, and given this amazing, huge platform to just really have some fun. It was great.
Well, I have to imagine that probably the toughest part for you is the destruction of Earth, because in my opinion, as a film fan, I think that's an audiovisual reference to James Cameron and James Horner's Aliens, the destruction of Earth, and it just never ends. Mm-hmm. Dun, 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 dun. And having to hit every one of those beats to picture beat. I mean, was that like an editing nightmare?
And no, because, it was, but it was their editing nightmare, because Garth got me to write it, and then we wanted to edit to what I wrote. And they had a great deal of difficulty doing it. You get it back and say, well, that's not hitting the beats. And they go and do it again and again and again. So I wrote it, and they cut it too, which is so Garth. He's like, I want this to be about the music. You write the music, we'll cut it to the thing. And, Paul Finn said the same thing to me as well, about how, can you please just write it and we'll cut to it? Because why not? I mean, something like that. It's like, I mean, this is Garth's, pop video thing coming back. You have the pop song, you might have to make the picture fit it. So he was kind of used to doing that. Yeah, so the idea with the destruction of Earth, it does a huge build, but then it doesn't stop, it just carries on bigger, 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 bigger. And the chords get thicker and crunchier, and the orchestra gets more and more and more enormous. And then when finally the actual explosion happens, it's deeply underwhelming. It's like... There was a whole massive scene that got cut in that movie that was one of the biggest things I wrote when we recorded in Prague. And I should have put some of this stuff on the album. It's really stupid. But anyway, there was when they went to Biltvoetl, the planet, there was this whole sequence where Biltvoetl is like constantly blanketed in fog, which hovers 2 foot off the ground. So there was all just smoke except for people's feet. And there's this whole sequence where you just keep all these progressively crazier alien feet that he keeps bumping into in this big crowd scene. They must have been fortunate they cut the whole thing. But I'd written this lovely cue in 5/4 for it, which is really good. And then I wrote a big march for the Vogon, which is on the closing it's on the closing titles of the movie. But I didn't put it on the soundtrack album. Anyway, there we are. Live and learn.
Well, if there's a way to get that unused cue, maybe I'd love to share it with our listeners. If you're free to, please send it my way. I tell you what, can you flip it back? Just play it backwards, right? And I think we get around legalities and license issues. So
I know it's so right. There's all this stuff, and you think, wish you could share. Maybe I just can. I'm sure other people will just post it. Mm-hmm. I might ask somebody, and if I find I can, it's really good. I mean, as I say, that we use some of it on the closing titles music, so it is out there. You always pretend you just recorded it off somebody, recorded it off the TV, but yeah, I mean, it was great to be able to go away and just write have a go at the material. I've never done it before or since, but it's like, you know, go away and write an entire piece of music for, you know, it's about one character, and then you have all that kind of material in there, then you can repurpose for once you get into the actual, because the thing is, you know, cues are so short and they're so constricted in a movie, especially these days, and you know, every film is so full of stuff. But you know, like a 30-second cue is pretty long. But I'm used to, in my, you know, my other work, writing pieces that, you know, like an hour long. So nice to be able to kind of go what you said. This is Bogan March. I wrote like 3 minutes long. It was where the Destruction of Earth music came from. Those kind of thudding chords.
Oh, very nice. Well, like I said, I'm a fan of your work, and whenever I listen to your, I feel like you have, what you do is you create, like what Joe Hisaishi does for Miyazaki films, that level of heart and warmth. I feel like you do that to live action films. So it's been a joy to chat with you about these very passionate projects.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Before we leave, let's just end on some fun stuff. You grew up on, you know, some fantastic and varied albums from your mother. Is there, what would you love to give to your kids? Is any of that worth it? Is any of it not? Any of your own personal record? Like, what three records are you going to excited to show your kids one day?
Well, they'd have to listen to Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, a lot. It's like it's not a very original choice, but I just think it's the most perfect album. And then, you know, film music, I mean, again, I'm sorry to be so predictably dull, but, you know, they're not going to listen to The Empire Strikes Back. They're going to be in trouble, you know, just saying. And then, you know, in the classical world, there's so much beautiful music that I just, you know, just completely. Now, the Ravel First Piano Concerto, that's a lovely piece. People, if your listeners have never heard that piece, listen to the second movement of the Ravel G major piano concerto. Just, you know, give yourself a treat. Like 7 minutes of just heaven.
What's your victory dance? Whether you get a cue approved and you're done with the project, or you have to suffer the invariable fate of having something rejected or cut. What's your victory dance and your sort of sympathy fuel?
Well, I mean, I find one annoying thing is that you're really in the thick of it. And you're thinking, I can just get to the end point. It's going to feel so good. But by the time you get to the end point, you know, you've been basically kind of like climbing out of the kind of, you know, the swamp, and it becomes progressively easier at the end. So the last few weeks, especially when you're scoring, actually, you know, in the room with real musicians, it's like, it's so fun. But you get to the end of the project, oh, do it again now. it's weird, but with you know, I always reach for a good bottle of wine after a hard day's work. It's a bit of a no-brainer. And then as regards kind of trying not to be derailed by you know, the deflation of something not working out, well, that for me that's a big problem, because I'm a very emotional person, and I can quite easily get kind of thrown by stuff not working out. So I have to be very much kind of on my guard with that one. Try to make sure that I'm emotionally invested, but not so emotionally invested that you know, I can't let go if I have to let go. And when I have to make changes, I have to, or rewrites or whatever, I find that as long as I can keep myself believing that we're heading in the right direction and things are getting better, then it's okay. And it's been a long, long time since I had to do changes where I couldn't make myself think that. So far, so good. It's always a worry though, because as soon as you don't really understand what you're doing and you just think you're treading water or you're just or going backwards, even worse. And that's where I kind of just, I'm not the kind of person who can just kind of deliver, you know, stuff that I know to be subpar and be okay with it. It'd be really hard for me to finish anything that I didn't really believe in. And I'm sure that's the all the kind of great composers you've been talking about. I'm sure it's exactly the same for all of them. It's what makes But what makes film composers good from being just mediocre? I mean, God knows there's an awful lot of mediocrity out there, but the stuff that's really good, you know, the Mike Giacchino's, of this world is that they're never going to let anything out that isn't brilliant. And that's the bar, and that's where you gotta be.
Well, I think that's a good one to go out on. I'm excited to hear about how the ballet works out. Excited for Sing 3. Anything else on the horizon you might hint at, or you just got you excited for?
I've got a ton of classical things that I'm meant to be writing a big choral piece for choir in Texas, big like hour long ensemble choral piece. That's going to be fun. Sing 3, I think, is in the pipeline, and another movie with Garth Jennings. After that, I hope, and also he wants to work with me again, so watch that space. Yeah, I've got a busy few years ahead of me. It's gonna be fun, it's gonna be hard.
Well, we're gonna be here cheering you on. Joby Talbot, thank you for your time, and we will catch you next time.